of short notice. Testing, testing. Yeah, it seems to be happening here.
What?
Loading source is better. Okay. All right, well, I'm really pleased that you're doing some promotion on this tour. This must be kind of unusual for you.
Not really.
Oh, yeah. Okay, of course, your solo material, yeah. You were...
Well, we've always done a fair bit, really. I mean, just...
Probably just felt like a fair bit.
Yeah, it was quite a lot. We did quite a lot, but...
Certainly in the early days, you had to do a lot.
No, we did more. We did quite a lot later on. We really did. It was just, I guess people think that we didn't for some reason. Maybe, I guess a lot of people didn't get the interviews they wanted and stuff like that, but exactly. We did do a lot.
Well, I want to talk right away about the new album. It's a tremendous album. I've only had a chance to play with it one night, but it was great. Did you tell them at all about the party last night?
Well, you tell them.
We had this party where...
Didn't invite me.
Yes, we did. See, you didn't pass it on.
No, we told Henry.
It was a very strange event. We had the whole thing broadcast over a short-range FM transmitter within the room, so everybody had headphones on.
Yeah.
It was great. It was a lot of fun, and we played the new album and everything. It's a really strong response. I want to ask you right away, what do you think constitutes a Pink Floyd sound? Obviously, when you're coming from having done solo material, which is distinctively different from a Pink Floyd album, you obviously have a clear idea of what you were shooting for.
I think it's... I don't know. It's difficult to tell. When I do a solo album, I don't take anything into account from you know, particularly. I just go for it. And I have a different feeling about one or two of the songs that I would put on a solo album that I might not put on a Pink Floyd album. There's very, very little difference, really. I mean,
the sound that comes out is quite different, even though you've got your actual compositional style is distinctive, but there are certain elements. I mean, for example, Nick Mason is credited with sound effects.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you go about deciding on something like that?
I mean, Nick didn't do all the sound effects. There are various sound effects. Some of them come off records. Some of them Nick went out and got. We sent him out with tape machines and stuff and recorded them. And Andrew Jackson, our engineer on the album, was also credited with some of the sound effects that he did. Some of the other holosonic sound effects were done by some other people in Los Angeles.
Describe that process to me. What is that? Holosonic sound, is it like a
Kunstkopf
kind of thing?
It's one of the dummy head system things, but it has more to it than that. There are two or three systems around that are
using some kind of digital enhancement, probably.
No, it works on some technique that involves fooling the brain a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I don't understand it fully. The very best system is quite remarkable.
Well, I guess what I was shooting for with the earlier question was there's an ambient aspect. There's that sense of a flow that you're not shooting for. I guess probably coming from wanting to make a predictable Pink Floyd album or a Pink Floyd album that is recognizably a Pink Floyd album.
I honestly did not think about trying to make a recognizable or a predictable Pink Floyd album. I just tried to set my mind in the mood of it being a Pink Floyd album. And from then on, there were no rules and no strictures on what we did. We just made up the music, and if they seemed like it was good, then we just went with the flow of it.
How do you compare that to some of the earlier albums? Give me an idea of what composition was like on this album in particular.
Well, obviously with Roger gone out, it's very, very different. You know, there's a lot more pressure on me to come up with a lot more stuff. And it's very different because Roger would tend to want to come in with a whole structured thing, right? The Wall, he came in with a demo of the whole of The Wall. Now, quite a lot of it got, quite a few songs got thrown out and changed, and new songs were written, and the way the songs were done were changed, but there was a storyboard there to follow, basically.
The final cut even more so, I would think.
The final cut even was not quite the same, but the final cut, he didn't come in with it all planned out, but it gradually became planned and mapped out, but he very specifically didn't want anyone else to write anything on it.
What did that feel like?
What, doing that album?
Mm-hmm.
Mm, torture.
Yeah, that's sort of what I thought.
It comes across, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You're not supposed to laugh, Mario. He's one of your artists.
Well, what can you say about that? I know that's the question that a lot of people are wondering about. What can you say about the state of affairs there now?
Well, the state of affairs is that he's left. He left in 1985, December. CBS will confirm to you. They got a letter from him saying that he was leaving in December 1985. That's the end of it, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, he left. We carried on. You know, as you know, he's sort of trying to do various legal bullshit stuff, you know. Sorry.
We're a liberal radio station. We'll run it.
He doesn't have a prayer, basically. He doesn't stand a chance of stopping us. So we're not. It's not something I spend all my time worrying about. We're just getting on with doing our job.
You do a very good job, too. It's really good, this album.
Well, thank you.
The picture is very interesting on the inner cover. Why, for example, is Rick Wright involved again, but he's not really in the bold print?
He had left the group in 1979, I think, Rick went. And he hasn't really been around very much. He lives in Greece most of the time. And we haven't seen an awful lot of him in the last few years. He doesn't come to our directors and shareholders meetings and stuff that we have to have in the real world.
That's what you look like. That's what in the cover. I was trying to think of what you look like in the cover, and you look like shareholders, like some big ad company somewhere.
Anyway, we decided to make this album. Nick and I decided to make this album. Roger decided he didn't want to and told us we shouldn't, and we said, well, we're going to, so, you know, and we carried on. And after we'd started, we spoke to Rick, you know, on the phone from Greece, and he expressed an interest in coming and doing some stuff, and we thought about it and thought it'd be a good idea. And he came in basically quite late on, after most of the stuff was sort of done, basically, and did some playing on some of the tracks, but...
And he's on the tour.
Yes, and he's on the tour, but he wasn't originally a part of the whole procedure. So, you know, as he wasn't a part of the thing from the outset...
How's he feeling about it now, having gotten back into it with a very different type of Pink Floyd going on?
I'm not too sure. I think he seems to be enjoying himself. I mean, we've been too busy to even sort of sit around and chat about things like this yet. So I don't know what will happen in the future. I have no idea.
I guess one thing that is interesting about a Pink Floyd like this now, and it is distinctive when you have a different, basically a different lyricist going on, and not such a major extent. And by the way, at that point, who is writing a lot of the lyrics here? Are you writing all the words? There's a few names credited. I just wanted to get an idea of who those people are. Who's A. Moore?
Anthony Moore is an English songwriter. And he is the guy that I collaborated with on three lyrics, on The Turning Away, The Dogs of War, and Learning to Fly. And all the others I did myself.
And Phil Manzanera is there. What was his contribution?
Well, he and I wrote the music for One Slip.
That is a great album, a great song, too. From which A Momentary Lapse of Reason, the title comes.
Well, A Momentary Lapse of Reason was there already. I slipped it into that song.
Why that title then? You had that obviously as a concept out there.
Well, I had two or three different titles that I liked a lot, you know. And that was one of them.
Just out of the blue, just a...
And, well, you know, it's something that ties it all in a little bit, I think.
It's interesting because I produced a special about the band that ran on Monday night, and one of the prevailing concepts that I kept harking back on is the concept of insanity and madness that runs through everything, and obviously having Syd Barrett right at the outset, and it's like a running theme that is it's hard to avoid. And I wonder...
Well, whoever in this band, it's sort of already decreed that whoever's the leader in this band has to go mad eventually, so I'm next, right?
This was in the contract when you got together at the outset. Speaking of which, what does Abdabs mean?
Well,
Is it a key change sequence? That's what it seems like.
Abdabs. Well, that was one of the early group names, wasn't it?
Yeah,
the Screaming Abdabs.
I wondered if you used it because it was a key change sequence of some particular song that you'd.
No. It's when you are very bad the morning after you've drunk too much, you get the Abdabs, the Screaming Abdabs. It's like it's a type of hangover.
Well, while we're talking about words, there was a couple others.
There's no Abdabs on this record, though, is there?
No. Abdabs.
Oh, we're talking history.
We're talking history. Umma from Umma Gumma. Was that from Dune?
No.
No, okay. These are all concepts that had thrown at me, and I wondered if that was true.
No, Umma Gumma was just one whole word that was in local usage.
Auximenes.
Auximenes, well, he was a person, wasn't he? Auximenes, in Greek mythology.
I looked it up and I couldn't find it yesterday.
Let me think. I'm not even sure myself on that one, to be honest.
There you go. Okay, those are from the blue. Now to get back to
back to the present day. Now is it?
Back to the concept of madness and insanity, and using a momentary lapse of reason as the as a title, having that making a whether conscious or unconscious continuity.
It never struck me that way at all, no, that it was had any sort of anything to do with the type of madness things that Roger has explored. Mm. And
did you feel he was obsessed with that in some way?
No. He is obsessed, but not with that.
it's such a lighter lyric. The whole album has such a lighter lyric to it than Pink Floyd usually has. Did you even lighten it less than you would have?
No, in
keeping in mind a Pink Floyd album?
No, I didn't. I did it exactly the way it felt like it was right to do it, you know, within my own capabilities, you know, which is, I'm not vastly experienced at writing lyrics, and, you know, it's kind of hard work, but we struggled over them for a long, long time, or I struggled over them mostly for a long, long time.
How long were you involved with this? Writing of this one?
Well, there were one or two bits of the lyrics written before last September, but mostly we started in the studio putting together the music and the words, and we finished this June, the end of this June.
How does that compare with your solo work, like About Face, for example?
Well, I guess it wasn't too different, really. My last solo one was done over a 6-month period. It was finished over a 6-month period. But I think the songs were more completed before. You know, I was actually closer towards completed songs before my last solo album. And we spent the first, 3 months on this one, really writing and restructuring. And I mean, you could call it pre-production, but we have the luxury of being able to do it in a proper studio. So, which most people, I guess, would do in a rehearsal room, sort of thing.
I wonder when you undertake a Pink Floyd album, do you feel like you're taking this huge mantle upon you, or unlike a solo album where you can explore freely?
Yes, you do, I suppose, but it doesn't happen like that at the beginning. Just gradually you start feeling the sort of responsibility of it more and more. But if it's getting better, and if your confidence in what you're doing is growing all the time, you're thinking, well, it's actually got something rather good here, then it doesn't get too heavy.
What do you feel responsibility to the fans, to the shareholders?
Just to the idea and to myself.
Pink Floyd is a very strong idea for you.
Yes, I sort of tend to think it's an attitude and a way of thought, really. More than it's any one individual person. The fact is there aren't very many of us around who actually share that attitude and know what it is. So,
I guess I have a question relating to how you relate to the fans that follows up on that. Do you believe that the fans have that attitude? Certainly, obviously, Roger Waters depicted that the fans seem to be quite separate, the whole concept of the wall being a separation from the people who supposedly were loving the music. So how do you relate to that?
I tend to think that his view on that it tends to have been very soured by a small minority of people who tend to go to shows and do tend to spoil it a bit by, being very rowdy when you want to achieve some sort of atmosphere. You're trying to create a sort of thing, and there are some people there who are only there to party, really, and they pay their money, and I mean, good luck to them, really, but they do make it much harder. But I think they're a small minority. I think there's an awful lot of people out there who know exactly what we're trying to do and are trying to share it with us. And there are moments when it definitely works, I have no doubt in my mind.
How does it compare over time, having performed live for so long? Can you see a pattern, any kind of transition?
No, not really. I could maybe tell you more tomorrow. We haven't done a gig on this tour yet.
This is the first gig on the tour.
Tonight, yes.
How have the rehearsals been?
They've got there. I think we're getting into pretty good shape, but it's been a long, hard road.
Who on the album is also on the tour? I noticed Tom Scott, for example.
Nick Mason. Well, Nick, myself. Rick Wright.
Tony Levin is credited.
The only other person, the two other people are Scott Page, who's a sax player from Los Angeles, who's doing the tour, who played on the Dogs of War, and John Corin, who's a keyboard player, who also played on the album.
How does it feel? I mean, you've only had there for, say, 3 weeks to work with a lot of people.
It feels great. Okay. It's good. It's all tying well together.
How's the actual... One thing I noticed when I was rehearsing or researching the special was how many times you would change a single show on a tour. You'd get a report from one city where you did one thing where this was inflated and that went then. The next time it was completely different. When would decisions like that be made and who would make
it? It wouldn't be that common, actually. We would change the songs that we did and the numbers around a little bit. But generally speaking, we would do a show pretty much the same all the way through. We may have discovered a new effect and put it in, or we may have thrown out an effect that we weren't liking or something. But generally speaking, I think that's just different ways different people describe it, probably.
Maybe they just experienced it differently. It was actually the same show.
Yeah.
How much actually is going on compared to, I mean, obviously not The Wall is a little bit extreme, but some of the earlier shows, say The Animals Tour, or somewhere around there.
Well, it is quite big, actually. I didn't think it was going to be at first, but it's grown in scale, and it's actually going to be as hard to transport as The Wall was. It's going to be much more expensive to put on than The Wall.
Really?
So it's
is that just inflation or?
Partly, I guess, yeah.
Hmm.
There's quite a lot of, you know, new technology being designed and
how many
built.
Of the people that were involved in the, you know, technically touring those the show were are still involved now? Actually, I should move forward because this is good stuff for putting on before the show, so I should get a good sound up. I want to get something on the air before the show tonight, so give them a taste of what's to come. What time are you going to hit the stage?
Should be at 8:00, I believe. No, The team that we've had before is not together the same way as it was then. So it is, we have got one or two of the people who have worked with us before, but a lot of them are very new, and it's a lot of it's hard work giving them the sort of the learning curve, you know, teaching them how we do things and the way we like them to be. So
how do you do things? You're doing a lot of, do you do much cueing from the stage yourself? Do you have headphones on, that kind of thing?
Not usually, not if I can help it. I try to get everyone to know what they're supposed to be doing and get them, you know, so they don't have to think about it. You know, you try to teach them enough and run through it enough that they know it, like, automatically exactly how to do everything, you know, there are things that I like the sound of. Like, I have to go and set up the sound for something the way I want it to be, and there's just no one else who can really do it. I have to go and do it and show these guys, and I have to go out and listen to it a week or two later and check it in sound check and see if they're still doing it the same way and if they've slipped from what I like, you know. So there's a certain amount of, you know, trying to be in several places at once.
It must be kind of an awesome feeling to be involved. Oh, yeah, still get your tea going. To be right in the middle, say, of a wild mix, and to feel the spectacle, kind of going strange on you, not being able to do anything. Has that happened to you?
Well, during rehearsals, constantly, yes. I mean, this is what rehearsals are for, is to get that all right.
But you can stop and say something. In those conditions, you can stop and yell at somebody.
So yes, well, this is the idea, is that you get all that stuff done and out of the way before.
But when you're in the middle of a show and, like, the completely wrong cues are going by, it must be a wild sensation.
Yep, pretty frightening.
Not much you can do.
Hold it. We're going to start that number again.
We have done that.
You have?
Yeah, we have actually done exactly that. On the very first wall day, we did that, in fact.
I'll bet that
when
was
we
cool.
had a curtain was on fire above us.
I read about that, yeah, that's right. Well, I hope nothing like that happens here tonight. Well, the rain, we got English weather happening, I don't think
yes.
there's much problem with that.
Well, I hope. We did a rehearsal in the rain last night, it was pretty frightening.
Is it covered enough? I mean, there's a lot of power going on out there.
It's covered enough, but depends on how hard the rain is and how strong the wind is. The wind is more of a problem than the rain. If the rain is just falling down directly, then it's not too bad. But when there's a wind, then it blows it everywhere.
Are there
and there's about 50,000 computers going down.
Are there going to be inflatable things this time around?
Wait and see.
That's when I was just thinking, when you said the wind, that'd be a problem. You might have to.
Yeah.
Who would make a decision?
No, but the wind I was talking about is the wind and the rain at the same time. Last night was blowing all the rain right across the stage. We had to have, you know, all the keyboards and all the keyboard players, and Nick was actually sitting under plastic tents of plastic sheeting, you know. It sounded awful where I was. The mic friends, I guess, were picking it up all right.
Would you you'd do the show anyway under those conditions? Is that,
I honestly don't know. I mean, there would be a point where we could not do it. But we intend to do it.
Historically, did you ever do shows in those kind of conditions?
Yeah. I don't know. Did we ever? I can't remember if we've ever had to cancel a show and come back and do it again. You know, but
that'd be quite an undertaking when you're setting up a stage like that.
Yeah.
Would you lose that much more money on a show? How much?
Well, I don't really know. I don't understand the business side of it or what the insurance is. I imagine there's some sort of insurance, but you know, for these things. But I don't understand that area.
Yeah, it's going to be on tonight.
Ask my manager.
Yeah.
Is the weather going to clear up today?
5 o'clock. It's going to be clear.
Yeah.
Is it?
It should be good tonight.
Yeah. Moisture used all morning.
Where's some wood?
There's
some
no
plastic.
Wood here.
Some fake wood to touch.
They said that it was going to clear by 4 o'clock.
Oh, well, I'm sure it's the odd rainfall, the odd drop. So, what is the proposed length of this tour? I've only seen like 4 or 5 dates listed.
Well, we're running up till the middle of December here in the States. North America, as I should call it.
What decision brought you to Ottawa to start the tour of all places?
Well, you have to start somewhere, and you plan a route with distances that aren't too big so that you can physically move it from one to another, and you tend to start at the top right bit and sort of zigzag down the east coast of through eastern to central Canada and the States and down a bit, and then go across the other coast and work up that one, you know. And so we'll probably wind up in Vancouver at the end or something, I imagine. I don't really know, but I mean, they work this thing out that sort of way, and we did rehearsals up here, so it was.
I like being the upper right hand bit. There's something kind of positive good about that. I don't know why. So is it? That just slipped my mind. Once I looked at the word "slip," and my question completely slipped my mind.
Mm.
What is it of this album that you like performing the most? Just from rehearsals, obviously.
I don't know, really. The Dogs of War goes over very well, I think. I mean, not to an audience, but to me it feels like it's a good one for live. On the Turning Away and Sorrow, both are really good fun.
There's a quote in there. Is that an actual quote from someone, or just the
no,
because of the sound of the
it's just
the voice?
Yeah, it's just a spoken sort of thing.
Again, I'm looking, every time I look at the word slip, my brain just goes blank.
You get that.
What have you done with
you? You must be having a momentary lapse of reason.
I've had a momentary lapse of reason. I shouldn't be looking at these words. Does the new machine relate to the new deployed?
No.
Okay. Oh, I'm having the word machine, obviously.
Mm. I read an interview with Roger yesterday that was in some magazine with some woman called Sasha something, where she had told him, obviously tried to goad him into being extremely rude about us, and he obviously didn't want to be. But she had told him some of the titles. She said there was this one called The Turning Away and Sorrow and New Machine. They're all about you.
That's like them talking about your solo album, the one song.
You know I'm right.
Which I had never thought. It was only when I read the interview that someone said that it was relating. It obviously was about a woman when I.
Yeah, well, it started off, the first verse was all about a woman relationship type thing. But then after that, when I only had written the first verse, we'd put the track down, I'd just done the one verse and I got it on, and people started saying to me, "That's about Roger, isn't it?" And I went, "No, it's not. Rubbish." But I hadn't written the rest yet. Of course, I couldn't write the rest of it without that after that. You know, I mean, I had to make the rest of it relate to that a little bit.
Interesting.
Just
you
for fun.
Bring up the idea of communal writing at that point, songs.
Your idea on the song can get affected if you haven't written it all by the time you present it.
Well, obviously the way you did a lot of.
But none of these have got anything to do with any of that stuff. It's just such a pointless exercise to get into bitching about other people in your music and your art. It's just not worth it. It's too insignificant. There's much better things to write about in the world and
of course that was
petty squabbles between me and Roger. You know.
That was the criticism of I Wish You Were Here, having so much self-conscious about the record industry and everything.
Yeah.
It's like an introspection of what's going on.
Well, I don't mind introspection. It's just petty bitching that I'm bored with. Still, I'll probably do a bit more before I'm done.
I guess
second-hand tea.
One thing you used to do.
Tastes even better than the first one.
I like cold tea, actually.
Yeah.
Do
you want
a
coffee?
Is that yours?
No, it's yours.
Yeah, no, I'm wrapping up. Oh, yeah, I'll just one more question. You were talking about composition, and a lot of the songs changed in the early days, things like Raving and Drooling and songs like that would evolve through live performance. Are you going to be doing any new material that isn't even on the album that you're going to, in other words, start evolving the tour?
I haven't planned on it yet, but I have got quite a bit of other stuff, and I don't know, it's a good idea. I might even try it, who knows.
That's because so much will be new to so many people anyway, that you might as well, you know, write stuff on stage. It seems like a good way to develop material.
Yep, well, I'm Raving and Drooling and You Gotta Be Crazy both basically got changed to fit the Animals concept. They had their names and their lyrics before, and fundamentally the lyrics didn't get changed very much, but Roger just re-angled them, and when he was desperately scraping around trying to find a concept to tie this album to, which is what it felt like a bit at the time, He came up with that idea, and I think he realised that those other two songs could be quite easily steered into having new titles and just a couple of tiny changes of direction in the lyrics. Basically, the lyrics didn't change.
Are you changing any Pink Floyd type songs? You know, actually, the actual library. Are you going to be doing any changes to material on stage?
A little bit, yeah.
Lyrically, conceptually?
Not lyrically, no, not really.
Conceptually, how would the inner sleeve, the visual, such... So
I was thinking of changing the lyrics to Wish You Were Here, actually. To Glad You're Not Here. Oops, cut.
You have a visual director in one of the members of Hypnosis?
Storm, yeah. Well, he sort of did the cover design and stuff for us. I've had him doing some bits of filming stuff for us.
What's his name again?
Storm Thorgerson.
Is that sort of an ongoing collaboration that's going to continue? Because obviously it's such a distinctively Pink Floyd visual kind of effect as well.
Well, he's done most of our albums, most of our album covers before, but he hasn't really generally been involved in any of the other areas of stuff that we've done in the films and things too much. And his involvement again on this one is the album cover basically, and generally supervising a lot of the areas of artwork that are being done for various sort of fields. And he's also done some of the new filming and has helped to re-edit and put together one or two of the old film pieces that we've sort of been tarting up a bit. So I don't know. I mean, we haven't discussed further than this immediate project and the things he's currently doing. He's working on a video at the moment for us.
Speaking of visual things, why hasn't Pink Floyd done more soundtracks since those early days, when you've got such an obvious ambient soundtrack kind of power to draw on? Why no offers or just no time?
The offers that tend to come in, they're really not usually worth doing, you know. I mean, it's not that much fun actually doing soundtracks half the time, because you get these, you know, you usually wind up at the end of the budget as an afterthought when they've spent all their money on these glorious visuals, and the music tends to come a very distinct second or third place, and then they generally really don't want to pay you anything, and they then want to take a percentage of your record and writing and stuff. Seems to be quite an attitude about it being an enormous privilege to do these things, and that you should be paying for the honour. But
unlike a wall.
Yes. Well, we put that together. You know.
What did you think of that?
The wall. I think it was pretty good, but not anywhere near as good as it could have been.
What did Roger think of it? I'm interested in that.
Well, you'd have to ask him. He said I read an interview where he said he watched it and it didn't move him. But I think this is... Roger has become unable to truly collaborate anymore, you see. Everything has to be his way, exactly. And it was absolute torture for him doing that, because Alan Parker wanted to do things one way and Roger wanted it to be another way. I mean, Alan Parker's view on it is that it's a good story and he'll take a basic sort of story and script and stuff, but then he has to be allowed to make the movie, which is a point of view. If you take him on, then you have to accept his point of view. And we took him on and we accepted that point of view at the beginning, but then Roger started moving the goalposts afterwards and wanted to change things and wanted to do this, that and the other, and made it in... I mean, I could see how, you know, Roger was obviously thinking it wasn't going quite right the way he wanted it to be, and I had sympathy for that, but I just, you know, I didn't think there was any way that Roger could have made the movie, you know, directed a movie. You know, Roger could, if he wanted to try and direct a movie, he should try it, but he should try it on a low budget thing. You know, he'd get some practice in, you know, on a major thing like this, sort of a big multi-million dollar movie budget thing. There's no way that anyone was going to let Roger take that risk, you know.
But certainly video work in promoting an album. I mean, is Thurgeson doing your videos as well?
He's doing a video at the moment for us, yes, which we sort of collaborated on writing.
Will it be similar footage to you'll use on screen? It would be the Dogs of War, or which one is it?
It's on Learning to Fly, we're doing it.
Oh, that's right, of course. Which is great. Is that from personal experience or anything? Who's learning to fly?
Well, it actually, funnily enough, is from... it was from an idea of Anthony Moore's, about learning to fly, I think,
But you're not getting your license, are you?
I have just got my license, yes. Myself and Nick both have private pilot's licenses, which I passed mine this April, just a few months ago.
How much time have you had?
I have had very, very little time. I've only been up in a plane about two or three times since then, since I passed my test. I shall have to get a few hours in to make sure the old license doesn't lapse if I'm not careful.
What does it feel like, just to wind it up, because I know you want to get...
There's no hurry. It's all right. Don't worry about it.
It's okay.
Yeah, fine. No problem.
What's it feel like now in your personal life going out on it? Because you haven't... I guess you've been touring your solo albums quite extensively, so it hasn't really changed that drastically.
No, I feel... I mean, yeah, it's like getting into an old set of clothes or something, you know. It's quite a normal doesn't feel that unusual to me at all. It feels quite natural and quite normal, and it feels like I'm going to enjoy myself quite a lot. So,
how about Nick? Are you both family men? You've got full situations to deal with at home. So,
yep.
You're on the road, what, 3 months this time?
Yeah. My family were all out with me while we were rehearsing in Toronto. But they've all gone back. Kids have to go to school, you know. Have to get some education beaten into them.
We don't need no. Do they throw that at you?
No. They were all a bit young when that came out.
How old are you?
From 2 to 11.
How many do you have?
4.
Wow. That's impressive.
I've been busy.
What's it like around the Gilmore home there? Are you wailing away on the axe all day long?
No. I don't usually even have an electric guitar at home most of the time. But I have my work studio place a couple of miles from my home. And I've got all the guitars and stuff I need down there. But
how many guitars do you have now? I know you had a whole
bunch. I don't know, lost count.
You had a bunch stolen at one time. Are you a collector?
Kind of, yeah. Not that enthusiastic a collector. Actually, my roadie, Phil, has been a large instigator in forcing me to get into guitar collecting as a hobby. So I think we've built up to something over 100 now. But they're all in storage at the moment because I haven't got anywhere to put them.
How many do you go on the road?
I probably got about half a dozen out with me now. But they're all the ones I've got on the road are fairly new.
Are you doing anything unusual? Guitar-wise, synthesizing?
No.
Nothing out of the ordinary?
Straight, boring old Gilmore guitar, I'm afraid.
Trademarks
out. Do you get asked to be tutor people? I would think that someone with your kind of experience would get a lot of offers from you.
Yeah, but there's nothing I can't teach people. I'm hopeless at it. I mean, they just have to go away and learn a little bit. Copy other people for a little while till they can play a little bit, and then for me, all the only advice I can give them is be different to everyone else. Don't be the same. Try and do something different. Be original.
Who do you listen to?
I don't listen to guitar players very much, to be honest. I like the sort of the standard classic ones that everyone likes. I like Eric and Jeff Beck and.
And what you think of people like Robert Fripp?
I'm not interested in his style, frankly. It just doesn't appeal to me particularly. I'm sure he's very good. He seems like a nice guy and everything, but the areas that he chooses to explore in guitar playing they don't personally. Sort of, they're not to my taste. I prefer Eddie Van Halen, really. I also like a lot of also very influenced by Joni Mitchell's guitar playing, for example. Leadbelly's guitar playing.
Do you know Pat Metheny?
No, don't know Pat Metheny at all. I'm afraid I've never got around to listen to anything that he's done. I've heard him on the radio a couple of times. Sounds like he knows the right one in from the other sort of thing.
I recommend As Falls Wichita. Mm. Great album. Really.
John Fay, he's another guitar hero of mine, if you like.
Do you listen to anything? Do you have a...
Yes, I listen. I tend to like songs. I don't sort of get hooked on whole albums terribly much anymore like I did when I was young. I tend to like one album track or something. The Gabriel album was the last one that I thought was consistently very good all the way through.
Have you ever sought out some of these people to collaborate? I mean, for example, seeking out Pete Townsend at one point was a very positive experience.
Yeah, working with Pete's great. He's a real good guy and very talented. And, he's terrific to work with. Yeah, the shows I did with him and his band at Brixton in England were just magnificent, terrific fun. There's a tape of it out now, but it just can't capture. You just can't get that big sound. Something like 20 musicians up there. I've lost count. Don't know how many there are. There's loads of people up there. Big. 9 brass section, and we were doing stuff from Charlie Mingus to Pete Townsend solo work, right through the gamut of rhythm and blues stuff. Everything is just absolutely terrific.
How much rehearsal time would you have to put in to make something like that work?
We did a week, I think. We did something like a week for that. I mean, it wasn't very long at all. I mean, it was all charted out, and we really had to get our act together to get it right in the period. I can tell you.
So it was like a bunch of session jazz musicians.
Yeah. So, well, you know, a bunch of people from all over, all sorts of different kinds of musicians and all kinds of different music. It was terrific fun.
I mean,
I've been and played with a number of other people. I like to go and play on other people's records and do gigs and stuff. You learn a lot. You're never too old to learn something new, a new trick.
I'm surprised Kate Bush never had you on one of her, especially her later albums.
Well, I sang on one of them. I did some backing vocals on them, and actually, she just asked me to play on this one that she's doing at the moment. But I was coming here, and I was absolutely up to here with various little bits of work. I actually had to turn her down. So,
okay. The world's missed out on that one.
She's great, Kate. She's terrific. I did a show with her in London, in fact, in February, was it? The Secret Policeman's Third Ball. It's called the Amnesty International show that was on in London in February, which I imagine will be out on video at some point. I played a couple of songs with Kate.
Who else was in that show?
Oh, Peter Gabriel, Lou Reed. God, who else? Hundreds of people.
When you discovered Kate Bush, she was like 16 or something?
15, I think, yeah.
Is it true that they just held her material back until they thought she was old enough?
No, I don't. I think that's the record company blurb, you know. When we started her off, I put her together with an engineer and a producer and an arranger and a top studio, and I chose the songs out of, she had about 40 or 50 songs, and I picked three, and I had this friend of mine who's a arranger producer, and I gave him the songs and said, listen, get this all fixed up, take her in the studio and do these songs as masters, not as demos, because I said I'd already got demos, and I knew that from the way she sounded when she was plonking away on the piano, it took, you know, a better than an average A&R man's ear to spot the talent in it. So
how did you actually interact with her first? Where did you first run into her?
She was the sister of a friend of mine's friend.
So it's who you know.
And my friend came to me and said, listen, my friend has a little sister who's really groovy, you know. Have a listen. So I said, all right, I'll have a listen. But you know, I was kind of busy at the time doing other things, and I didn't really have the time to get deeply involved with it. So I just spent some time listening to the tapes, doing some demo tapes with her and stuff, and picked out songs, sent her into a studio, and made three masters, which I then took to EMI and said, do you want this? And they listened to it and said, yes, we'll have it, please. And they put two of the tracks, which were those demos, on the first album, but they were recorded like 2 or 3 years before the other thing. And what they were actually doing was that they were putting her with various different producers. They didn't want to use the guy that I'd originally used for some reason, and I think the delay was more about thinking she hadn't got enough good songs and the producers just not getting the right thing out of her, because they were putting her with the wrong people. And eventually a guy from EMI came back to me and said, come on, Dave, it's all right, we won't say anything, but admit it, you sold us a dud here, you know. You gave us, you know, you sort of conned us by making the only song she'd ever written that was any good sound so good that we took it off you. Just, I mean, we don't care, you know, it's okay, it's normal business, but admit it. I said, give me a fucking break, you know. This girl's really talented. And they said, well, we just can't get anything right. We can't get it right. We've tried it with God knows who, and there's this person and that producer, and we haven't got anything out of it. I said, well, why don't you go back to the guy that I put her with originally? They said, well, you don't like him very much. And I said, listen, he's good. He knows what he's doing on this stuff. Give it a try. And that's when it started. That's when they made the album, and it was plain sailing. But they wasted 2 years pissing around with the wrong producers for her and stuff, and claimed it was waiting for her to mature and all that sort of bullshit.
What is it about record executives that make them that way?
I don't know.
I mean, you know, record company executives are often more concerned with business, and they have to be. I mean, that's their job, is they have to make the, you know, the profit and loss accounts match up at the end of the year, you know, and it's a very unforgiving business, so that is geared towards that being the case. And a lot of the people in the A&R side of it are people who would have preferred to be singing or playing the guitar themselves and weren't quite good enough to do that. So they, you know, or being a record producer. A lot of people tend to be a little frustrated in those areas of record companies. Excuse me, Mario.
I agree with
most cases. I would bet that right after that, after word came out about your discovering Kate Bush, that you got like 1,000 demos.
Yeah.
That week.
Yeah, lots of young girl singer demos I used to get from that. And every time you get involved with anything like that, you get hundreds of second-rate copies of the same thing coming through to you. That's what I've been getting in the last year, is lots of sort of dodgy Dream Academy copies and stuff.
What, offers to produce or?
Or you know, them sending things to me personally if they can find me, or record companies asking me to produce people. Yeah.
So now that you're back with Nick, how much time has gone between the last time you worked with Nick?
Nick Mason.
Yeah.
Well, we worked together during the making of the Wall album, the final cut album, and the final cut. No, the I mean the Wall the Wall film. God, the book of the film. Can't keep up with it. Yeah, we were working together through until late '82, I guess, on stuff. And we got back together last year to do stuff. I mean, he guested on a couple of my solo shows and stuff. Yeah, I will.
Just lean over and
pass out on the microphone. Where were we? What were we talking about? Oh yes, and I sang on a single on his album, on his solo album, and I appeared in the video of his single.
And this isn't Fictitious Sports you're talking about.
No, the last album he did. What was it called?
Rick Fenn.
Yeah. Eye for an Eye. An Eye for an Eye was the single, wasn't it?
That's right.
It was
the 12-inch CBS.
Was there an album released to that?
As well as a sampler.
Which you said this.
I thought you knew about that. When we talked about
Fictitious Sports, I didn't know there was one.
There was one with Rick Fenn afterwards. Mm.
And we share an aeroplane. We bought an aeroplane between us. It's just a single engine, small thing.
So you live close together?
Well, he lives in central London. I live outside central London. We live within 15 miles of each other, 20 miles. I don't know. But he has, we like to play with toy racing cars and stuff, big ones, big toy racing cars and toy aeroplanes and stuff like that. So.
Like what kind of racing car?
Well, quite big, very quick ones.
Like what?
Nick's got hundreds. So Nick's got a vast collection of incredible racing cars, from old Bugattis up to Gilles Villeneuve's Ferrari F Formula One that he was driving a few years ago.
Gee.
I've got a BMW M1 Pro car, which is also quite quick, quite fun.
Do you race? Do you compete?
I have competed once in a while, but I generally tend to just do circuits against the clock rather than against people, you know. Against people you get a bit too aggressive and fired up about it all. It's the red mist, they call it.
The red mist.
Behind the eyes.
Have you ever had any close calls or scares?
Yep.
I'm surprised we haven't seen a song.
About racing cars?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah. Done learning to fly. Learning to crash next.
Is there something? Is there an adrenaline buzz you're getting from that? What is it? What motivates you to?
I don't know. I enjoy it a lot. I suppose it's the classic little boy's adrenaline thing that everyone gets. I like to be able to do everything, you know.
What other thrill sports have you gone for?
Well, I go. I sail. I like racing Hobie cats. And I like scuba diving. got a scuba diving license, and racing cars, aeroplanes, anything. You know, I like to learn. I like to be able to do everything, basically.
These were all dreams of you when you were younger.
Mm. Later in life I started thinking I'd hate to sort of get to sort of growing rather ancient and doddery and think, my God, I wish I'd done that, you know, I wish I'd done something else. So everything that I ever wish about, I try and get on with and do. Yeah. I haven't managed to dare do free fall parachuting yet, but that's the one which is my bravery is just not up to at the moment.
It's the one thing I've done.
Is it?
Yeah. I've sailed, but that's all. Do you feel like a dilettante sometimes when you realize that you've got the capital there to do these things that you just...
I suppose so, yeah.
Doesn't bother you?
No. I like to be a sort of a jack of all trades, you know. I'm not bothered whether I'm a master of none or anything like that, you know.
Does it leave you time to write the music? I guess that's the question.
Yeah, it does. Seems to, yeah. No, I mean, these things that I do, I did do the flying lessons and the test concurrently at the same, you know, while I was doing the album this time, but usually I try and find a spare moment to do these things.
I wonder what it'd be like composing a song while you're up there, having a tape recorder going.
Well, I think it probably wouldn't be too good an idea. It's rather important that you concentrate on what you're doing.
Free fall, though, you don't have to really concentrate when you're in free fall. You got lots
no,
of
but you have to remember to pull the old bit of cord, you know.
Yeah.
If you're dreaming about something else...
Yeah, what a riff! The Walkman survived, though, so they have for the post-mortem album.
Okay, yeah.
Well, what other things are you going to do? What are you going to try for? Those kind of things. That's obviously
anything else that I can think of. I'm still trying to pluck up courage to try free fall parachuting at least once. I learned to fly a helicopter, I'm quite keen on the idea of, but I don't really like them that much, so I think I'd like to just take a few lessons just till I know how to actually control it and probably leave it at that,
just to go up and down G.
Yeah, just so I could say that I could actually, you know, I could feel that I could actually fly one of the things. I think that would be real good fun, but I don't really like the idea of this thing whizzing around above you that your life is clinging on. You know, there's a certain logic to wings that I sort of am fonder of.
Once you've seen the footage from Twilight Zone 2, you get a little disturbed by helicopter. How about
they're pretty safe these days.
Well, if you're in a big plane, you haven't got much more glide ratio.
No, you can glide okay in a big plane, but.
Not a 747.
Yes, you can.
Well,
you can probably from normal cruising altitude, you can probably glide for 100 miles of land quite safely in a 747.
Yeah,
it's only seen.
Actually,
it's not the impression you get.
A couple of weeks ago, I flew a 747 simulator at the Air Canada's one they teach their pilots on.
Oh.
They let me take it off, fly it around Toronto, and land it again.
How does it look? Is it a video or?
It's computer generated graphics that are stunningly realistic. I mean, it's nightfall, you know, it's dusk, so they don't have to be too exact with all the detail on the ground, but you know, you can see the roads and you see the cars going along them, you can see hotels and you can see everything. Absolutely great.
Sounds like a hell of a ride.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Best toy I've ever been in.
Then you asked to buy it, right?
What?
You asked to buy it.
I think they're quite a few million bucks.
You got one in Montreal, the same thing. It's gigantic.
How do you get it? How would you get access to something like that?
Well, we've been rehearsing on Toronto Airport in a hangar for a month, you know, so we got kind of friendly with all the airport people and they were very happy to let us do anything. Normally those things are booked up 24 hours a day, but I think they just had it closed down for a bit of maintenance or something. And they got a couple of free hours and they said, do we want to go and have a go? So myself and Nick said,
you know,
just try and stop us. And we both managed to take it off and land it without crashing it. Yeah. It's quite a thrill.
You're not going to turn into a Michael Jackson type on us and start doing really, really strange things.
No, I think the reclusive style isn't really my style, I think.
Are you a very public figure in London?
No, I have a very, very privileged situation where I can just do whatever I want. I can go to restaurants and go to, you know, take my kids to Disneyland and stuff like that. Do any of the things that anyone can normally do without getting any hassle. It's fantastic.
You must be recognized sometimes.
Yeah, occasionally, but not enough to make it, you know, to make it a drag, you know, it's fine.
They're not... I would think there would be a different class of people recognizing you from the solo things that...
Well, I guess, I don't know, I mean, it's... I certainly don't... It's not a problem, you know. It's not a... It's not a hassle, so...
You were a male model as a younger fellow.
Well, when I was about, 20, and I was living in London and trying to get a band together or trying to do something, one has to earn a living, and I had various jobs, but I did get to know one or two people who were in that business, and I could get two or three weeks regular job wages in a day if I did that sort of thing. So I mean, it was never something I did a lot of, but I mean, in those days, if they offered you that sort of money for a day's sitting around posing in someone else's clothes, I mean, Jesus, who'd turn it down? It meant I could spend a couple of weeks living, you know, without having to bother about a day job if I did that. So.
Was the even the early days of the band were at times pretty tough?
Well, they weren't tough. When I actually took a wage drop from my previous job when I joined this band for a while, because the band had some debts. We had sort of two lots of equipment stolen and stuff, and was still having to pay the old hire purchase companies off on the equipment that we didn't have anymore. So
where did it really turn around? When did you get to the impression that you were actually going to be rich?
Well, God, it always progressed. It always moved upwards from the time I joined. It pretty much always moved upwards. There were periods of time after the first year, through 69 and 70, when I didn't really think that we knew what we were doing. We were sort of struggling to find a new angle and direction for what we were trying to
that
do.
That would have been around...
Uma Goomer and Atom Heart Mother Day, so I'd say we're pretty, a little on the low on the inspiration side myself. I mean, some people think that they're their favourite albums, but they're not mine. But nonetheless, the popularity and the trend of where we were going was moving up steadily through all that period, and moved up again with the Metal album, which did, I think, finally sort of show us the way forwards.
Well, what were the sales like on Metal?
They weren't great. I can't remember. I mean,
I wouldn't have thought it would have only been after the fact that a lot of people would have come back.
Yeah. No, I mean, we could sell out arenas around America, you know, 12,000, 14,000 seater arenas all around the States. But we could still not sell any records before Dark Side of the Moon, really. And we did.
It's usually the other way around, of course.
Yeah. No, but we were known as a live band. We always thought, and other people used to say about us, that we couldn't actually record properly. We weren't very good at it in those early days. And we did arenas. God, and we did the Hollywood Bowl. Sold out. And we got a picture of that. That's a beautiful picture I've got of that somewhere. And that was in like 1972, I think.
Would that have applied to something like Atom Heart Mother when you were touring the full orchestra and choir? Were those good, great live gigs as well?
They were quite fun. Yes. Yeah.
As opposed to the album, which was a little bit rougher.
I guess I don't know. I can't really remember. It's a long time ago.
It's a long time ago. How about acting? This is something that you were originally going to appear in The Wall. I understood at one point
No, at the very outset, there was some talk of putting some live footage from the shows into the film to illustrate things or to be narrative passages, but that got dumped pretty quickly. It seemed to be unnecessary. It wasn't going to further the picture's aim. So.
It was a shame, though, that the documentary footage of the shows didn't turn out. Nothing came of that. What was the technical problem?
I just think the company we got to film it weren't good enough, or they weren't strong enough at telling us you've got to have more light on stage or something like that. I don't know exactly what the problem was, but we've looked at the footage and we've got it all. We've got, it's all on video, hundreds of reels of video, but it's,
I just don't, anything will ever happen with it?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't had the time or the energy to look at it closely and examine whether there's a possibility.
Is it worth doing?
I don't know. If it was good enough, it might be worth doing. It's just one of these things. You need a certain type of director with a certain type of eye who can try and make something as big as that, look as big as that, on someone's tiny TV set. Mm. And mostly, if you try and make something huge, if you try and put it, the scale of what the wall shows was what it was about, partly, you know, I mean, a very big scale. And that scale is really hard to get onto a little screen. So.
Interestingly, that the film version, to achieve that sense of scale, used like so much cutting, so many different types, of rather than going to a visually large image, it's a lot of images happening. That's sort of the only way you can do it when you're...
Well, I don't know if it's the only way, but I imagine there's more than one way. But,
yeah, well, I'm... how are you feeling? You want to keep going?
Fine with me.
Yeah, you're having... What are you doing today? What's your day?
Well, I have to go down to the stadium, basically, and do some checking on a number of things that weren't right yesterday and try and get them in shape for tonight.
What kind of things are rough?
Well, some film synchronization problems, some music synchronization things where people didn't... I mean, we're still working on things, you know.
I guess you'll probably still do the first week of shows.
No, we are ready to do the show properly, but we do want to change the sets around and do different shows, different nights and do stuff like that, and we're not ready to do that yet, so...
You want to change it as you go?
Yeah.
How can you plan something like that in advance? After a show, come up with an idea of, wait a minute, that didn't fit in well there?
Well, that also might easily happen, but I have actually already worked out several different sets, different set lists that we will be attempting to do.
You're doing that just for your own, for the variety, for your own experience?
Yeah, for us to make it not too boring and to make it interesting for the people who come and see.
Are you going to film any of these? Is there going to be any?
We have not as yet discussed it.
Do you regret not having done more of that through some of the earlier years of live shows, where you've maybe had one spectacular night that you wished you had some record?
Yeah. I mean, the Dark Side of the Moon tour, the shows on that tour, I mean, I definitely think we should have filmed and taped and recorded it properly, but we never did.
I saw you when you performed in the Autostad in Montreal, and you timed the Dark Side of the Moon half of the show for the rising of the moon over the stadium, or at least
that was the way it seemed.
That was the way it happened.
That was the way it seemed, yes. Well, you know, lucky accidents like that happen quite often, actually. I mean,
phenomenal.
It's,
That was a memorable show.
That was fantastic. Do you remember what shows jump out of your mind? That was the Autostad in Montreal. I don't know if you remember. That was where you were doing the Dark Side of the Moon in the second half. Was that 73?
Yeah. You started the show with Crazy Diamond from The Wish You Were Here. And you played You Gotta Be Crazy, which in those days was called You Gotta Be Crazy.
Yeah, right.
I reviewed that show a long time ago for the paper. So I looked at my review actually a couple of days ago.
Do you remember any specific shows like that?
I remember some of them.
Jump out of you.
But often I can't remember where it actually was, unless it's a venue you've played more than once. If you've only done it once, sometimes you can remember the building, but you can't remember what city it was in. You get confused, you know. You tend to know roughly where it was.
You must
the
remember.
One I can think of is one that I thought was in Toronto, but maybe it was in Montreal. I don't really know. I can't remember. You remember, there are some spectacular ones that you remember. We did one in Pittsburgh. It was amazing because the roof opened. We had an indoor arena with a roof that opened, and we were sitting around in the day, and the hall manager came up to meet us and stuff, and was telling us about the hall and stuff, and said, we've got, you know, actually the roof is in these sort of cake-like sections, and they all slide around and all wind up behind one section, which is one sort of slice of cake shaped section, which was behind the stage. And we said, really? And we said, can we see it? He said, oh no, it costs an awful lot, we're not allowed to do it. without said, paying. We said, how much? He said, it's $200. And we said, we'll do it, we'll do it. He said, oh, we can't do that. We said, why not? We've never done it. Said, why can't we do it? They've never done it. So we actually managed to persuade them to do it. We did the first half with the roof closed. This is on the Dark Side of the Moon tour. And we started Dark Side of the Moon. We started the intro take. And we said, hit the button. And he hit the button when we started the intro tape. And it chug, 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 and it all came up behind. We had not honestly realised what was going to happen. But I stepped up to the microphone, and this wind went, and all the heat and the smoke just went straight off this building. And I went, breathe, breathe in the air. And I went, whoa!
I know the Olympic Stadium show was also often quoted.
What did you think of this?
The wall, the beginning of the wall.
The big old, you must have known and recognised the venue.
Yes, the Olympic Stadium I remember well. It was not a great gig, unfortunately, and Roger, his story that he tells from that night is, I didn't see it or hear about it. So it wasn't really, you know, I just think we didn't play very well, and I think it's a great shame to finish a tour. That was the last date of that 1977 tour. And it's always a shame to finish a tour badly, you know, because your memory of the whole tour gets coloured by the last gig. For example, the last gig on my solo tour was on the pier in New York. It was great. It was really steaming good fun, you know. And that leaves you with a good memory for that whole tour. And unfortunately, the 1977 tour, although there were a lot of great moments in it, tends to be soured a little bit in people's memories, because the very last date, the one you left with, was a bit of a downer, you know.
And the wall also using the graphics, Gerald Scarfe's graphics, uses that. It looks sort of like the Olympic Stadium, the one tower.
Yeah.
The one tower in the Olympic Stadium goes all the way around, and people right up.
Well, I remember, because I was close, there was this guy in the fourth row yelling during Pigs with Dogs, and yelling like a madman, like rock and roll and play time or something like that.
Yeah.
And Roger spit on him.
Yeah. Well.
And that's supposedly.
That is supposedly the event that, and probably is, you know, but, you know, like I said before, that type of situation, guys like that are a pain in the butt, you know, but they are not, it's not everyone. And it's a great shame that people around people like that don't sit on them or something, you know.
It's one out of 60,000. Just
funny. Yeah, it's a real drag. That when one person there who's like that can spoil it for nearly everyone there.
It's an interesting thing happened at this party last night. Mm. We had posters around the room that we were giving away, and there was this girl that had won this one poster wall. She just loved it, and she was really happy she won it. It was still up on the wall, and some guy was stealing it. I saw it from the other side of the room, so I got on the microphone. I said, Grab that guy, stealing the poster. The guy had the poster down, he was going, get them up against the wall. They grabbed the guy and got the poster from him, which they wouldn't have done if I hadn't.
Just one rotten apple.
Just one guy. One guy.
That's usually the way it goes.
Well, it's a shame, you know. I mean, yeah, they've paid their money, but I think it's kind of irresponsible to spoil other people's enjoyment like that.
Do you think there is something about a Pink Floyd fan, though? I mean, the concept of a Pink Floyd fan.
They're not just Pink Floyd fans. I mean, the people who come to our shows are people who go to all sorts of other shows as well, so they are not specifically just a Pink Floyd fan, but I hope they become a Pink Floyd fan for the night. At least.
Well, you're aware you've got a very dedicated core of followers. I mean, some people, I mean, just CBS in Montreal, we must get easily 3 calls a week about Pink Floyd. From people just want to know what's happening. Those people seem to live for what's going on.
And yet you say you don't get recognized that often.
No.
Do you think that's just the anonymity of the music being...
I don't know. It's just we've never promoted ourselves particularly as our faces have not been that highly promoted. Oh. A bit more in recent years, but...
It's there. It's more like the nature of the music.
No, I mean, here in Ottawa and around today, I am much more likely to get recognised by... There are people who would recognise me today who would not recognise me if I'd been walking around the streets of Ottawa 6 months ago, simply because there's an expectation. I mean, they are expecting me to be in this town because it says I'm going to be here and I'm going to be playing at this stadium tonight. So.
There's something about the focus of the material too. The material isn't a ego or personality focus, as say a Whitney Houston album or, you know, your classic, where what the person is doing when they're listening to the music is focusing on the actual personality of the person performing. Yours is very, it's very selfless.
Not totally, but yeah.
But just think about it, Jim. Between 75 and 85, there's not that much footage of Bigfoot. Mm. You know, there's not that much available stuff.
That's true. You've got Live at Pompeii and then...
That's in 72. 72. Yeah, there's really not much between 75 and 85. And I know, because I was looking at all the CBS files a couple months ago, and there's nothing.
That's true. Mm.
There's a documentary on the wall, half an hour,
but basically there's not actually a single, I don't think, real film of a Pink Floyd concert anywhere ever.
No.
With properly recorded sound and properly filmed.
And yeah, it's a shame. I mean, that is a real shame.
Especially the wall. There was only 20 shows for the wall.
35, about.
Most of them in New York, Los Angeles, and in Europe.
Yeah. London, Germany.
You did shows in Germany.
We did a week in Dortmund or somewhere like that.
Was that added on at the last? I thought it was just...
No, there was always going to be the four cities. Los Angeles, New York, London, and Dortmund. We then put on another set in London a year later, which was supposedly to film the bits for the wall film.
Was that... Such a scale. I mean, such a scale when you've got that kind of construction going on. I mean, is that distracting to you? Tiresome? How does that feel?
It's a different sort of show. It was terrific. I mean, I enjoyed it immensely. It's not something I'd have wanted to do hundreds and hundreds of times, because it is slightly restrictive musically, because it's a theatrical production. You've got to work to strict cues and tapes, and there's a lot of very strict cues and stuff to do, which means you've rather got to be concentrating on getting lots of little things right, dead right all the time.
How about that ballet that you were involved with shortly in Paris?
Well,
was that inspirational or
no, it wasn't really anything that we had any deep or lasting interest in. It just seemed like a good idea at the time. We basically just gave them a tape and they rehearsed and choreographed to tape of the way we played some songs, and they did it before we were with them, and they did it after we were with them with tapes, you know. And we went and did like a few days playing it with them on a stage in Paris and in Marseille.
What was it like?
I'm not a great ballet fan myself. It's kind of meaningless to me.
So they weren't doing a ballet that was more a modern type of performance.
Well, it kind of was, but I didn't. It just wasn't something that deeply interested me. So
there's no dancers on this tour then.
Nope, not really. Just me.
You've got the dancers in the blue light video. That's great, though. That's quite nice. Did you enjoy doing that?
Yeah, that was quite good, yeah. I mean, that's one of these situations where I'd sent it off to a number of directors and stuff and just not managed to get any sense out of any of them or any idea of what I liked out of these video directors. And in the end, I sort of started writing the script myself and wound up writing it with Storm and... Storm doing it, so which is what tends to happen, because I don't like what anyone else sends me.
It looks great. Well, no, it's a great collaboration. You've got one of them. Should continue it. The video, what's it going to look like for Burning the Flower?
Oh, you'll see.
Do you use footage in the show from the video, or is there a crossover?
No, the video is only just being shot now.
You gotta go.
That'll do.
Alright.
Wrap it up here.
That was great.
Stranger Media. To find out more about the works of Jeff Green, go to strangermedia.com.